I'm Maylili Lee. Thanks for joining Virginia Conversations. For too many senior citizens these days, financial abuse is a reality. Today, we have a panel of experts who will explain how vintage Virginians are falling prey to financial abuse. According to a national survey conducted in part by one of today's guests, older folks are being ripped off at a rate of more than $2.5 billion a year. And the ones doing the taking are more often than not relatives or so-called friends, even trusted business professionals. To shine a light on this problem, we have in the Richmond studios Jim Rothrock. He's the commissioner for the Virginia Department for Aging and Rehabilitative Services, and in the studios of WVTF in Roanoke, Janet Brennan, elder abuse prevention specialist with the New River Valley Agency on Aging, and Virginia Tech professor Karen Roberto, who is director of the Center for Gerontology at Tech. First, we're going to hear from Maria McPherson. She's the associate director of the Mental Health Association of the New River Valley. WVTF reporter Beverly Amsler interviewed her at a recent workshop on elder abuse.
There are situations where there are people who plan this. They groom their victims. They build that trust. They make them feel like they're the only person in the world that they can depend on. They isolate them from other people in their social circle. And slowly, they may start to take advantage and take money and take away. That's what we call undue influence. Now, there are other cases where there's maybe a sense of entitlement to certain things, or, you know, where a family member starts out with all the right intentions. They're going to be a caregiver for an older adult in their family, say, but then they start to think, oh, well, I think because of all the work I'm doing that they should help me take care of my car because of all the running around I'm doing. Or, you know, I'm sure they won't mind if I borrow the jewelry that they're never using anyway. Or they start to just push the boundaries of what they're having access to in terms of finances. And then they maybe get more relaxed about writing checks for the older adult. And maybe they feel like, oh, well, I'm really short on money this month, so I think they can cover my groceries. And so I think there are situations where that ends up crossing a line into financial abuse or exploitation, but it's harder to discern because that person has also been providing care or support in some ways. That's what makes the cases so difficult to identify.
That was Maria McPherson, Associate Director of the Mental Health Association of the New River Valley. Karen Roberto, that audio clip illustrates one of the findings in that National Elderly Abuse Survey you helped conduct.
Yes, it did. We had the good fortune to work with the MetLife Mature Market Institute, along with the National Committee for the Prevention of Elder Abuse, to look at financial abuse across the nation. My colleague Pam Teaster at the University in Kentucky and I were the academic researchers on the team, and we used kind of an unconventional way of trying to put a face on financial abuse. We were able to obtain news clippings from around the country. It was through a service provided by the National Center for Elder Abuse, where they scoured all newspapers, and we then narrowed our focus on those that really looked at financial elder abuse. And so what we found was that we could really classify the financial elder abuse as really coming from multiple directions, but really three main ones. Those coming from family, which was probably the most hidden and the hardest to identify. Those coming from businesses or professional care providers. And then also looking at abuse from a more systemic perspective.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Virginia Conversations, a production of Virginia Public Radio. I'm your host, Maylili Lee, and we've been talking about medical treatment and the rights of a minor to have a say in their course of care, We're joined by Rose Cheriks and her son Wolf. Their family's story is the backbone of what's now known as Abraham's Law in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Also joining us now from the Charlottesville studios of WVTF Radio IQ is Dr. Margaret Mormon. She's a medical ethicist specializing in the interdisciplinary scholarship that intersects ethics, religion, and medicine. She's the director of programs in biomedical ethics for the University of Virginia Health System. Welcome, Dr. Mormon.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
This is an interesting conversation that an entire law evolved from Wolf's case, Abraham's Law. Of course, he was known as Abraham back then, Star Child Abraham. What is your opinion of this law, which now states that if you're over 14 years old, you should be given the option of determining your medical care?
Well, I'm sort of two minds about it. I remember I wasn't there when he did it, but what Justice Holmes said, which is that hard cases make bad law. One of the difficulties with the law is that it removes the ability to make nuanced decisions. That's my concern about it. I certainly understand the reasons that the law was passed, and I think there's some good that can come out of it. But I'm a little concerned that it doesn't allow for the ability to think about whether this particular 14-year-old or this particular 15-year-old actually is capable or of making the decision. That's one concern I have. But then, you know, we know that there are 30-year-olds who are not really capable of making a decision. That's why we have a bright line at 18 for that. And the question has always been where that line should be. It's interesting that we could change it to 14 for this, but we're not changing it to 14 for other things.
Bioethicist Arthur Kaplan is quoted in the Virginian Pilot as saying that he's not crazy about the law, pretty much piggybacking what your concerns are. One family's situation could be entirely different from another family situation, the common denominator of age 14 not having that much of an impact in whether it will be a good decision.
I think that's right. I don't like taking away from our society the ability to make case-by-case decisions about something like this. It's the problem with bright-line laws is it does tend to take away our ability to think in more nuanced fashion.
This is Abraham. I was actually wanting to reply to that. I think that there's a keynote in the law that actually makes it pretty much the exact opposite of what you're saying, and that is that the law does not say that 14-year-olds have the right. It gives doctors the ability to make educated decisions on these children. It gives the doctors the ability to say if the doctor's judgment on this person is good, if they think that this person is mentally stable, if they think they're mature, and if they think that their decision is in their best interest, the doctors can give the family permission. The doctors still retain all of their previous rights to deny the family that leisure by, of course, contacting social services or not even giving them the initial the statement that they can do what they want to do. The law simply opens up the possibilities. It does not actually claim that the children have the right to make these decisions on their own.
Well, thanks for the clarification. That's very helpful. But then I'd have to ask, what's the point of the law, since doctors could always do that?
I'm going to do us both a favor, as interesting as it would be to talk about some of the mudslinging between you and your opponent. I'd actually like to hear about your vision for Virginia. Let's start with education.
Mm-hmm.
You're the father of five.
That's right.
And at a recent forum in Richmond, you said that you would like to see Virginia get rid of its SOL, Standards of Learning. Why so?
Well, I think we have to get rid of them in their present form. They don't work for parents. They don't work for teachers. And they're clearly not working for students. The idea of this high-stakes, multiple-choice test at the end of the year is forcing teachers to teach to tests. It's having our children learn memorization, which there's nothing wrong with that. But we've got to have our children be thinking creatively, cognitively. And why do we possibly give the test at the end of the year and generally with 2 to 3 weeks left at the end of the year so the students don't have anything to do? If we really want to help the students earlier in the year, maybe short essays, maybe a couple of them through the year. We want to be able to gauge our students' progress, and we want to be making sure that we're preparing our students for those 21st century jobs.
Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli, welcome to Virginia Conversations.
Good to be with you.
We seem to be swept up in scandals this election, the situation with the governor's former chef and the CEO of Star Scientific. Then there's the investigation of the actions of an attorney in your office. And pile on top of that questions about Mr. McAuliffe's business, questions around why he's not making public 8 years of tax returns as you have. It has to undermine the public's trust. How do you repair that?
Well, I called for a special session to address some of these ethics issues. Governor didn't agree with me. I think that's unfortunate. I think that an aggressive stance to try and restore the trust of the people of Virginia is very appropriate, and time is your enemy in that. I mean, the longer things linger, the more difficult it is to repair.
Now, the Libertarian candidate, Robert Sarvis. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Virginia Conversations.
Thank you for having me.
Robert, currently there is no Libertarian congressman, no Libertarian senator, no Libertarian governor. So it would appear you're not running to win the race for governor in Virginia. What is your intent here?
No, we're running to win. The problems that we have at the federal and state levels are because we don't have more Libertarian-leaning members of Congress and the state legislatures. Part of the problem is that we have people who don't believe in the rule of law, who don't believe in protecting both economic freedom and personal liberty. And that's why we have a lot of voters who are gaining interest in my candidacy. My poll numbers keep going up. We're now in double digits. And that's because the Democratic and Republican candidates exemplify exactly what's wrong with their respective parties.
Today we're talking about Project Discovery, a program aimed at helping students finish high school. Our guests are Chief Executive Officer Jeff North and from our Richmond studio, two site coordinators with Project Discovery. Heidi Davis is the coordinator of the Quinn Rivers Community Action Program serving Fredericksburg, and Hermelinda Miller is the coordinator at the Office of Human Affairs in Newport News. Before the break, we had a call from Martha, a retired educator from Roanoke, and she asked Heidi about the emphasis on college, college this, college that. And it's a fair question because there are very legitimate things post-high school.
I'm going to pass this to Hermelinda. We're talking here in the studio, and we both agree on the same facts. So I'm going to turn it to my colleague.
Yes, thank you, Heidi. The caller is correct, and I can understand that not all students are going to pursue a college education. And in Newport News, we have most of our students, like for example, last year I had 77 seniors, and out of the 77 seniors, I had approximately 69 went off to college. But we had a few went into the military, and the rest went straight into the workforce. Project Discovery does focus on college, but we also focus on job interviews, job skills. We have people from VEC, Virginia Employment Commission, come in and talk to the students about how to do an interview. We have people from the military come in and talk about the different armed forces. So it's not just college, because we know that not everyone is going to college. So we do try to expose them to the various resources out there, the various institutions, trade schools that they can pursue. Definitely going out to work. We have a few students last year who are now in the workforce, and they had mock interviews while they were in Project Discovery. They met with the director at BC talking about the skills, interviewing skills and tips and do's and don'ts that you will do at a job interview. So it's not all about college, because we know not everyone will be pursuing a college education.
Now addressing socioeconomic factors and how they play a role in the performance of the student in high school. Susan from Richmond, I know you have a comment around that.
Hi, yes. And I'll kind of keep it brief, but I'm an educator, and I think that all of these programs are absolutely amazing, especially Project Discovery. I'm just really delighted be in a state that emphasizes education in this way and, you know, trying to equalize opportunity, be it for college enrollment or a good vocational placement. But I think some of the comments and some of the discussion that we're having here and generally around education, education policy, programs and reform, misses the point. And David Berliner, who's a famous educator, kind of calls this the 800-pound elephant in the room. And it's poverty.
Today we're talking about modern whistleblowing. Our guests are former NASA employee Richard Cook and Virginia's State Inspector General Mike Morhart. Mike, what are the protections offered to people who might come forth?
Sure. When folks call our hotline, obviously, as I described before, they can be anonymous if they want. That's one obvious protection that they have. The other is this. The Code of Virginia stipulates that no one will retaliate against a whistleblower or someone that files a complaint against the Commonwealth, and that's taken very seriously by our office. We've had a number of instances where folks have come forward to us and said, hey, I reported this to you, then my boss did this to me. We don't wait. We go investigate that, and we take appropriate action. The individual who may retaliate is subject to standards of conduct issues that's administered by the Department of Human Resources Management in the Commonwealth. And basically what that means is if the individual is found to have retaliated, it can be anything from an oral reprimand, don't do it again, with follow-up by us, to dismissal. So there are a number of protections in place, and I would encourage anybody who has called our hotline who feels like there's reprisal or whatever inappropriate action might have been taken against them to call us. We will address it.
And folks, this is not about human resources issues.
No.
It's about egregious acts that are endemic to an organization, whether it's fraud,
waste, abuse, or corruption.
Right. And how do we know that your office is an independent and neutral office?
Sure. Our organization, our agency, was established to report to the governor's chief of staff. That's who I report to. I do not report to a secretary, as is normally the case for other agencies in the Commonwealth.
We have a call from Beverly. Good morning to you. You're calling from Orange.
Yes. I was driving a school bus in a county in Virginia that I won't name. I was on a special needs run, which involves having another person on the bus, an attendant. I was driving along down the road, and I was looking in the mirror, and I saw the attendant slap a child across the face. And in that instant, I thought of pulling the bus over, getting my cell phone, and calling local law enforcement, but I didn't. I went through channels in the county school bus, you know, their channels, and that was the biggest mistake I could have made. They just took her off my bus and put her on another bus. So I emailed the school board and gave them a heads up. They might want to watch the tape of this incident and rethink whether this woman needs to be around children. Well, then the school bus people came after me in a big way. They didn't fire me, but they made it so ugly for me that I wound up quitting. So I was just wondering if your guests had any comments about anything I should have or could have done differently that would have saved my job and gotten the person out of that system where she wouldn't be around children anymore.
They may not be elected to office, but they serve the public and have an undetermined amount of political power. Today, a look at the roles of our first ladies in the White House and in the governor's mansion in Richmond. Welcome to Virginia Conversations. I'm Lily Lee. We begin with an author who has done extensive research into the women behind the men who have become president. Feather Schwartz Foster is author of the book First Ladies, From Martha Washington to Mamie Eisenhower, an intimate portrait of the women who shaped America. Feather joins us from our Richmond studio. Welcome to Virginia
Thank
Conversations.
You. Nice to be here.
It's fun to start these off with you because you have such a grasp not only of the first ladies in general, but you know the ties to Virginia. And there aren't a lot of them, but a great place to start is Martha Washington.
She was the first.
Tell me a little about Martha. We hear so much about the man. Let's hear about the woman behind the man.
Well, Martha was born and raised in Virginia. She lived here all her life except for, you know, brief, quote, semi-residences in New York and in Philadelphia, but she was Virginia-born down in the Tidewater, New Kent County area. Her family was gentry rather than terribly wealthy, but she married for the first time a man named Daniel Park Custis, who was very, very wealthy. And when he died about 7 years into their marriage, Martha inherited a great deal of property. And she also had two little babies at the time, 4 and 2. And then she married George Washington, and they moved to his place, which was Mount Vernon. And she, from the get-go, was a very domestic woman. She could manage that plantation, and she did it elegantly and well, from the kitchens to the guest houses and the guest accommodations. And they entertained extensively, and she was a real help meet and help mate to George.
And welcome back. We're taking your calls on Virginia's wine industry. Our guests are Annette Boyd, director of the Virginia Wine Marketing Office, international wine expert James Suckling, Gabrielle Rousey, who is an award-winning winemaker and Monticello's director of gardens and grounds, and John Boyer, a Virginia Tech professor who's teaching classes on the topic. This next call might be for Annette Boyd, director of Virginia Wine Marketing. James from Blacksburg, go ahead with your comment or question.
Well, I was wondering, a lot of the Virginia wines you guys have been mentioning are comparable in quality to many other imported wines, but one thing I notice when I go to the store is that they're higher priced. So what's a way that Virginia could get around that in order to make their wines more marketable?
What do you think, Annette?
Well, first, I'd like to say, yes, you know, the average vineyard in Virginia is about 20 to 25 acres. With that, they're small, artisan, family-owned farms, and So if you're talking about producing a wine that's going to be, say, under $10 a bottle, really we're not going to see that in Virginia. With these small wineries, they just don't have the economy of scale. But what we're finding is a lot of these wines that are priced at between $15 and $25 a bottle, and sometimes, you know, you look at some of the other bottles that are even priced up to, say, $40 a bottle, they are competing against wines in the same price categories. But we just, you know, there's those huge growers in Chile and Argentina and California that literally have thousands of acres, and they can produce bottles of wine under $10 a bottle. We're just never going to find that in Virginia. I don't think.
Today, Fresh Air meets Virginia Conversations as we welcome Terry Gross to the program. I'm May Lily Lee. Thanks for joining us. Terry Gross has been hosting Fresh Air since 1975. She's heard on more than 500 radio stations, reaching a daily audience of nearly 4.5 million people. Over the years, Fresh Air and Terry have received numerous awards, including the Peabody, which noted the host's reputation for probing and unexpected questions and unusual insights. Terry is also the author of All I Did Was Ask, Conversations with Writers, Actors, Musicians, and Artists. And next month, she's appearing at the Paramount Theater in Charlottesville. Terry Gross, welcome to Virginia Conversations.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here or there.
Yes, we are there.
I'm in Philadelphia as we speak.
This is the way you like to do it, right? Separate from the guest in a different location.
It's the way it is, whether I like it or not, because our studios are in Philadelphia, and we don't have the money to bring guests to Philadelphia, and they don't have the time to get there. So the only way I could talk to the guests I do is if I hook up the way you and I are hooking up now, which is long distance via ISDN line or satellite, whatever is available.
Let's say that you had every resource available and you could afford to bring in every single one of your guests. Would you still prefer this method of interviewing?
You know, they each have their advantages. The nice thing about being in the room with someone is that you have the benefit of body language. You see each other. Sometimes there is a special rapport that you get by being in the same room, but not always. Because on the flip side of that, sometimes there's a privacy and a sense of space that you get when you're not in the same room. And there is an odd sense of intimacy that you can develop when somebody's just in your headphones. And you're not in each other's physical space, but you're very much in each other's psychospace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, psychological space, because of them going directly into your headphones, and it's pure radio. You know, if I want to let my guest know something, it has to be through my voice. So anything they're finding out, listeners are finding out too, because there's no special nudges and winks and smiles and nods that are going on just between me and my guest.
Today, we're taking a look at Hollywood's impact on Virginia. Our guests today are Mary Nelson of the Virginia Film Office, Mike Kennedy, a film actor who worked on the movie Lincoln, Jody Kilbasa, director of the Virginia Film Festival. Film Festival's coming up from November 1st through the 4th. This is their 25th anniversary. So there's a lot of excitement, not only around Lincoln, but around the upcoming scores of films you'll get to see in Charlottesville. Robert from Franklin County, go ahead with your question or comment.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. My question is this. When they filmed the movie Lawless, which is about Franklin County bootlegging back in the 30s, we live in Franklin County. We wondered why it wasn't filmed in Franklin County. I think they went down to Georgia and kind of upset us. Does anybody have any insights as to why that happened?
Mary Nelson.
Yeah, I sure do. And the word is incentives. Georgia gave them a whole bunch of money to film there. We worked with that project from the beginning of the – I believe it was started as a book. And, you know, when the book came out, we identified it as a potential project for Virginia. And we went after it with everything we had. But at the end of the day – they had to go somewhere where the state was willing to invest more money in the film than our state was able to invest. So it was a heartbreaker. We've lost quite a few heartbreakers, and the ones that we are the most sad about are the ones that have a real Virginia tie, like Lawless did. It was The Wettest County in the World was the original title of the book.
Let's do a little time traveling back to the early days of the colonies to find out just how beer making in Virginia got its start. We have on the phone Laura Templin, interpretive site supervisor at Jamestown Settlement and Yorktown Victory Center. Laura, tell us a little about those brew pioneers.
With pleasure. You know, early Americans were brewers from the very start. We have evidence of brewing taking place at Jamestown Settlement almost immediately. We have advertisements for brewers to come join the colony from 1609, so only a couple of years after the colony was started. We know brewers were included among the tradesmen who came over with Sir Thomas Gates, one of the governors for the colony. So, you know, brewing beer was looked upon as a wonderful thing to do. And part of that was because beer and cider were looked upon as really, really healthful. They felt like it increased your strength and it made you able to withstand all kinds of health problems. And really, in a way, they were right, because the water was often polluted, and especially in Europe. But even here in America, there's evidence of people getting sick, of course, from just drinking straight out of rivers and so forth. And so people looked upon beer and cider as being a healthy alternative to drinking water. So it was common for housewives in the colonies to make beer on a regular basis to keep their families healthy and strong.
There is a real sterilization process in the making of mead.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, just the fact that they were boiling the wort, the beverage that the beer is made from, you know, of course, is going to get rid of germs. They didn't know that yet. They didn't have that scientific basis of the knowledge, but they knew prepared drinks were much more healthy.
According to a diary entry from a passenger on the Mayflower, the Pilgrims made their landing at Plymouth Rock rather than continue to their destination in Virginia due to lack of beer.
That's one of the reasons, sure, absolutely.
They just could have you know, checked out Virginia, they could have started making their own right away.
Well, you know, sometimes you can't fight the forces of nature, too, because it would have been difficult for them to come back down the coast with the sailing technology of their day.
Let's return now to our guests. Such a pleasure to have both of you with us, Dean and Maureen. And Maureen, I want to start with you as an economic development person in Nelson County. We see that craft brewing has actually become an industry, not just something people did in their kitchens. Do you see this as a trend? Is it something that will continue as true industry growth?
We certainly see that both nationally and as well as in the Commonwealth. We're talking about, in the United States, $250 billion industry, and in Virginia, $7.4 billion revenue for the Commonwealth. And you're talking 50,000 local jobs.